Hello, and welcome to Disrupting the Degree, the Education Marketing Podcast. I'm Stephen Cleary from Carnival Content with
Zeynep Fayaz
and Zeynep Fayaz from the Brand Education.
This podcast is all about higher education with industry trends, experts, and practical ideas across the student experience, brand, and marketing.
In this episode of Disrupting the Degree, we're joined by Ed Fido, Chief Executive at the London Interdisciplinary School. Welcome to the podcast, Ed.
Hi, nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Great. So should we just kickstart? So you're building a brand new university, so it's an exciting time. Can you tell us a bit more about LIS and why it's different to traditional universities?
Yeah, of course. I think the biggest difference with LIS from any other university is that rather than focusing on a single discipline, we are focused on complex problems. So the whole curriculum is focused on tackling big social problems like climate change or AI and ethics or childhood obesity or knife crime. And how the curriculum works is that rather than sort of sitting down and thinking, right, what are the modules of physics which we need to learn for the next 3 years or history or mechanical engineering, which is what I did at university, we start with the problem, let's say it's climate change, and then you'd say, right, what are the elements of chemistry or psychology or economics that we need to understand to be able to tackle this problem? And then that is what the students will be learning through that term. And then the next term, they move on to another problem. So that's the basic structure of it.
Wow, so it's completely different. It's almost like, you know, interdisciplinary research for academics. So now you've introduced that in a module and course format, right, as opposed to doing a PhD in something like that.
Yeah, that's completely right. And we think we're the first in the world to be a completely interdisciplinary new institution. There are some research institutions that focus on interdisciplinary research, as you say. So Santa Fe Institute in the US is one example. But yeah, this is a completely interdisciplinary degree. And every degree that we do in addition to this will be interdisciplinary. We do actually teach the students research methods as well. So methods like statistical analysis to analyze data or ethnographic research to collect new data. So in a way, the students are going to be doing these kind of interdisciplinary research techniques as well.
And in terms of like delivery, like how are the modules delivered, or is it similar to how, you know, other universities deliver their courses?
It's different. I wouldn't say it's completely different. I mean, the first thing to say with innovation in education is at some point you're going to have to kind of put your hands on your head and concentrate hard and try and take in some new information. I mean, that's what learning is. And then you're going to have to do it again because you've forgotten it. And, you know, all of that's hard to bypass. So learning's hard. And that's an important part of learning because it's kind of the one, it's not my words, but it's the residue of thought, of hard thought. Basically, it's what's left after you've been doing some hard thinking is what you've learned that's new. So it'll still be challenging and hard, and it is an academic degree. But yeah, we're organizing the learning in a different way. So first of all, by organizing them around problems means you can bring in outside organizations in a much more relevant way. So let's say we start term one with mental health, and we'll have partners come in who are working in mental health charities to talk to us about how they think about mental health. But we'll also have people from big organizations like, you know, investment banks or kind of big multinationals who come in to talk about how they think about mental health. And it's actually quite surprisingly sophisticated sometimes. But the important thing here is making connections between how people think about mental health in the world outside of academia and connecting it to what the academics are thinking about. So what are the neurochemists thinking about it, or the anthropologists? And then the students can kind of see both worlds, and they can start to see how they can use their learning for real. So we think that's very powerful. So that's one big difference. And I think there's also, just to name one other thing that is different from a structure perspective, is that the students will be spending a fair bit of time working in teams of five or six. So they'll be working together to kind of think about that problem. How are they going to tackle the specific part of mental health that they're thinking about for that term? And so they'll be working together towards an output, which, you know, of course, people do some of that at university, but this is sort of built into the core part of the degree.
How did it come about then? How did the concept for LIS and the idea to completely change and flip how a traditional degree is, how did you decide that?
Well, I think there's the leaders of the institution have come to this from different backgrounds and different paths and with different thoughts about higher education. And we've sort of organized ourselves around this central idea. But everybody had this idea that moving beyond this notion that you just have to study one thing at university was really important. Mm-hmm. Because we do need some people to do that. We need some people to sort of just study chemistry for 3 years, or of course, medicine or law and so on. But we also feel like we need, you know, a big cohort of people to be able to move between lots of different areas of expertise. So for me specifically, before this, I was in the school sector, and I'd set up a free school in 2012, and noticed that we were doing a lot of project-based learning at School 21. This is the school I started in Stratford, and that involves a bit of interdisciplinary work. But you start to think, wait a minute, and the students were doing lots of drama, and speaking skills was a big focus, and they were doing lots of art and combining it with science. You know, they were combining history with drama or science with art and creating these amazing products. And you realized by GCSE, they start dropping those subjects, which means they can't do these interesting combinations anymore. And then they get to A level and they're down to three or maybe four. And then they have to put on their UCAS form that all they've ever wanted to do is study one subject. And it's frankly not true for many of those students. And this just seemed kind of crazy. And that was the beginning for me of thinking, what is driving this kind of weird, narrow focus? And in the end, it's actually the way that universities are structured and the way that universities do their admissions. That's what's forcing us to do that in school, is my belief. So that for me was the beginning of thinking, what if you started a new university that did it a different way?
Yeah, and I love the fact that you bring in external bodies as well. So, you know, charities as well as commercial entities. I think it really gives a 360 of what learning is all about. It's not just based in, you know, a university campus. It's actually outside of that. Because when we enter the real world of working, or even, you know, socializing and meeting people within the workspace, it all comes with a whole different sort of perspective.
I completely agree with that. I mean, I think the big challenge of all learning really is transferring that knowledge into being useful in the real world. And it is the more technical term for it is far transfer. So how do you literally know when you're in a context that you should be using that thing you learned 3 years ago in your, you know, solid mechanics class or whatever? And education is quite poor at that, because in school, what you transfer your learning to is a very similar setting, which is the same building. It's probably even the same classroom, and it's in an exam, and you're doing stuff that's very similar to what you've done in class. So you'll never get that practice, which it is. It's a skill to practice of taking it outside. So that's what we're trying to do. And I think as well, you touched on that. It's important to get organizations from a range of sectors. And we also broker placements for students in different organizations as part of our offer. It's not part of the degree per se, but it's part of our offer. And we're going to be encouraging students to do placements at a range of different organizations, not just kind of zeroing in on one area, because you do learn from different sectors, public sector, private, small and large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the fact that you're using real causes that you're working towards, and it's all actionable, because these are likely to change in the future, which would, you know, keep on changing the curriculum that you're working towards.
Yeah, well, a big part of that is we have our own degree awarding powers, which enables us to do that. So we can make changes to our degree as we go much more easily than if we were having to be given our degrees by somebody else. So, and we're actually the first new institution to open with our own degree awarding powers since 1965, since Warwick University did it. So it's a long time. Every other institution in between has had to be validated by another institution or awarding body, which does make it harder to do something really different, because you've got to sort of map up to something else.
Yeah, definitely. And what do you mean when you say extraordinary teaching?
Well, first of all, extraordinary teaching should be happening in universities. And I think too often it's not. Sometimes it is. There's plenty of fantastic teaching happening in universities. But the truth of it is, if we're all honest about it, academics wake up every morning mostly focused on their research careers. That's what most of the incentives are, certainly at the Russell Group universities. And they're called research universities for a reason. The incentives for professional development are mostly, not entirely now, but they're mostly around how well your research career is going. People talk about a teaching load, which sort of, you know, it's almost like sort of paying your taxes. You have to go and do your teaching. And if you've got a really fantastic research project, you can buy yourself out of having to do that teaching. Literally, this is the language, which is a language you know is very important. Mm-hmm. And what we thought about was, what if every member of the faculty was waking up every morning thinking, how do I create an incredible 3-year learning experience for an undergraduate? Where's that happening? And it should be happening, because what we're putting in the school system is putting in so much effort to getting young people from all kinds of different backgrounds into university. And we put all this effort in, and also so many charities as well are set up to try and get young disadvantaged young people into university. And we get them there, and what happens? They're taught by people that would rather be doing something else. They're taught one subject by people that would rather be doing something else. And that doesn't feel right.
No, it doesn't at all. So who do you think your main target audiences?
So in terms of students?
In terms of students, yes.
Well, look, this has been something that over the last 2 or 3 years we've been very nervous about. I mean, who on earth in their right mind would come to a completely new institution like this, you know, to do a crazy course that no one's heard of? and so we didn't know to start with. So we went out and talked to lots of students at schools. And I think it's what's really surprising is that when you say to students, how many of you do you would like to stay broader for a bit longer, do more subjects through university than just one? Many, many students are up for that. I mean, it's sort of could be anything up to about half of the students. I mean, there's lots of students as well that said, look, I'm desperate to go and just study law, or can't wait to drop all these other subjects. And I understand that. But I, for one, certainly wanted to carry on. I'd have loved to carry on with a bit of English, but also carry on with some sciences. I did engineering, but I was also considering philosophy. I really didn't want to choose, right? And I chose engineering because I thought it'd be a bit broader, but really it's just lots of maths. That was a shame. But no, I think so the students who are up for staying broader, the students who are up, who are really excited about something bigger than themselves, so they want to tackle problems that matter. And I think that, and that's part of our interview process. So we have a very different, which I can talk more about if you want to know, but we have a different sort of admissions process, which involves interviewing everybody that applies. And we do want to understand what makes them tick. So that's a big factor for the students that want to come to us. And then the kind of final thing I'd say is they've got to be brave, because this is a new institution. We open this year. And there'll be plenty of bumps in the road and things. There'll be some fantastic aspects of the fact we're new and small. And there'll be some downsides to that. So we are also finding quite an extraordinary group of bold young people that are willing to take a risk to some extent, but equally see that just doing the same as everyone else is also has some risk factors attached to it.
Ed, I would probably be one of your ideal audiences, because that's one of the things I looked for in my degree, the broader aspect. Yeah, it was, I did business, media and culture studies because I didn't just want to stick to one area. And if this university was around back then, I probably would have chosen this, because for me, it's something bigger, like wanting to do something that's different, that's going to enable me to do something in the world. So I think
it's a tough decision, isn't it?
Yeah.
To choose one course.
It does because universities do try to do that, like by adding different modules, but you're still graduating in social science, or, you know, it's a particular area that you're really graduating in, but it's not that broad.
I wish they had something like this when we were applying for universities, because it really does make you think outside of the box. You know, everybody's got a different learning journey as well. It's not, you know, sometimes after A-levels, people go off to go into a job, or they decide to do a higher apprenticeship or go into a degree. So it's, you know, it's a different sort of alternative that should have or wish could have been provided.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. And your degree does sound, that you ended up choosing, sounds very rich and broad. But I think the other thing that's different, and I think quite hard for existing universities to do, is the sort of integrative bit, the bit that brings all these threads together. That's quite difficult for universities to do, because they're organized often in these disciplines for a reason, because they are very good at doing research often, right? And which happens in these quite narrow ways, or sometimes in interdisciplinary ways. But to actually organize learning in a way that integrates what you're learning in English with what you're learning in, you know, statistics, can be quite hard for them to do. You know, you sort of have to start the institution with that in mind.
Are you launching in September?
Yeah, we launch in late September with our first cohort of about 100 students.
Okay.
So we're interviewing now. We're interviewing hundreds of students now. We've had a lot of applications for this first cohort of the brave souls that are giving it a go. we're very excited, and we've got our faculty of 11 teachers who have actually. Well, I come back to what does extraordinary teaching mean. We made asked our applicant faculty, academics, to all teach as part of their interview process, which sounds crazy, but it sounds crazy that wouldn't be part of the process normally, but it almost never is.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to come and teach a lesson. They had to say, let's say they're an expert in anthropology. They had to pick a complex problem, let's say knife crime, and they had to come and think about how their subject would be relevant to that, and how they would teach a kind of interdisciplinary course on knife crime. And that was part, and they were teaching it to a class of students that were thinking of applying to us. So
awesome.
So and they gave them feedback, and they gave the teachers feedback, and we also were watching, and that was a really important part of the process.
Are you thinking about a kind of feedback loop then throughout the first few, or continuing, I guess, for the whole of the university, but especially in that first year from the students to the academics?
Totally. We've actually been running trials. We're just getting towards the end of it now, but we're effectively running the first term as a trial with 25 students currently. Obviously, we're doing it in the middle of a lockdown, so it's all online, but and it won't be all online when we open. But that is a massive learning curve for us. So we're making lots of tweaks and changes. But yeah, you're right. The first year, I'd imagine, will never look the same again because so much will change after it.
But that's a good reason for keeping that flexible approach going, though. So continuous improvement and being agile enough and small enough to do that.
I think that's right. And I think the notion of continuous improvement in education is not really prevalent enough. I mean, how many degree courses are saying, how can our degree course be better next year? That isn't really what people are talking about in university land. What they tend to talk about, and you'll know this as well as I do because you run a podcast on it, but there's a lot of conversation about, well, you seem to focus on new offers, which is exactly the debate that people should be having. But there's too much debate about access. Very important, but the debate tends to be about access and it tends to be about fees. And that's fine, but you can't do that in absence of talking about what it is that people are learning and how good is it? And is it getting better? Is it getting 5% better every year? Because if it was getting 5% better every year, your degrees were sitting now would be so much better than the one I sat 20 years ago. I'm not sure that's true.
Mm-hmm. And where are your students mainly from at the moment? Are they UK-based or they're quite international?
We're getting about 10, we've done no advertising abroad, but about 10% of our applicants so far have come from outside of the UK, which is interesting. And there's actually a real hunger for, or an understanding of the power of interdisciplinarity in Europe, particularly, it turns out, in Italy, Scandinavia and Holland and places like that, it seems.
Yeah.
And of course, schools that do the international baccalaureate are also sort of already open to a kind of broader set of subjects. Mm-hmm. But no, the rest are, mostly UK-based. And we've also got a very high proportion of students from disadvantaged backgrounds because we've made that a very big focus for our recruitment.
Is there a reason when planning your offer that you decided to stick with the traditional sort of three-year degree?
Well, yeah, this was an interesting one because if you're starting a new institution, you can break the whole thing apart, right? You could do anything. Mm. And so my feeling on this was if you did literally change everything and it didn't look like a university anymore, then you're not really having the impact on the system that I'd quite like us to have. So what I would like us to have is that other institutions look at us and say, maybe there's some stuff there that we could nick and that we could improve as well. And if you're completely different, first of all, universities will find it hard, won't think you're as relevant. And secondly, I think students would think it's not really going to university. So there's that risk. So it's like, what do you keep the same and what do you keep different? And then I think, and so there's some things we're keeping the same. So 3 years is the same, £9,000 is the same, and you can borrow against the student loan book. They're still being taught by academics because some people would say, why don't you just have them taught by people who already work in business? So there's some things that are the same, and then as much outside of that that can be different is really different. And it might be that over time we change it. But I think the thing with 3 years is, often people would say, well, that degree in philosophy, I could have done that in a year. Mm-hmm. But what we're saying is, well, we've got you for 3 years. What could we do in 3 years? How much can we pack in? Mm-hmm. And if you think about it that way, it starts to get exciting again. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah, because if you did say that we're not giving degrees anymore, it would be how many students should actually turn up, right? Because learning has become a means to achieve something, which is a degree or a accreditation or something. Like, so if you did something completely different, I guess it would be, you're too different.
There's only so far you disrupt.
Yeah.
Well, there's a few things. Look, we've got these degree awarding powers, right? That thing I mentioned about being the first since Warwick. And that wasn't easy. That took years and a lot of money and a lot of uncertainty that we were going to get it. So at various moments in that, when it didn't look like we might get it, you sort of look at each other and say, do we really need... What if we didn't award degrees? You know, every few months someone would say down the pub, what if we just don't actually give out degrees?
Is that where you're planning it in the pub?
What would happen? Basically, it's where you go to commiserate after sort of another regulatory knockback. but what happens is a few things. So first of all, students can't borrow for the loan if you're not giving a degree. You'd be much harder for students to pay you anything. And of course, you need to be paid. So that it sort of falls down immediately on that. But as we all know, people go to university for lots of reasons, and they go there partly for a credential of some kind so that they can show it to an employer, and that's perfectly fine. But something that does occur to me is that it's obviously swung far too far in that direction. And I think if you were to say to students that were applying, let's say you're there, you go in Freshers Week at UCL, and you polled a bunch of students and you said, you've got a choice. You can either get a degree certificate, you can get a first class degree from UCL, but you won't get to access any of the learning. You don't go to any lectures, you don't learn anything, but I give you the degree classification. Or you do all of the learning and you learn all that great stuff. You go to the lectures, you learn everything, but you don't get a degree at the end of it. Which would you rather do? And too often, I think students would answer, I'll take the degree, please, because that's what I need, and I don't really need the learning.
Yeah. So, Ed, would you say these degrees are exam-based, or are they modular in the sense that you do biannual assessments? How do you measure the sort of success?
We don't do any end-of-year exams, high-stakes exams as such, because a fair few universities are moving away from this, and it's genuinely not the best way to assess whether somebody knows a body of knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's very stressful, and we know about mental health issues at universities and amongst young people is only getting worse. So that's one way to alleviate it. But more than anything, there's better ways to assess. So we have various different ways to assess: ongoing assessment, coursework, exhibitions or work. You can create products like podcasts rather than necessarily always writing essays, but there'll be essay writing as well. There will be tests, but they're sort of more formative. So it's a range of different forms of assessment based on what's the best way of assessing that subject. The best way of assessing a mathematical subject is not the best way of assessing an artistic subject.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely, so correct.
Yeah. So Ed, you've had quite a diverse career. Can you give us a bit of a kind of overview on what you've been doing, and how did you come about LIS, and what have you been doing before that?
Yeah, so I've jumped about a bit. I'm not sure it would look like I was very reliable if you were looking at my CV.
You'd be like,
what is this? What has this character been up to? So as I mentioned, I did engineering at university, but I was also doing a lot of theatre stuff in my kind of social time at university, putting on plays. And then I left to do that full time with a friend of mine, and we were sort of really scrabbling around to make ends meet, sort of putting on musicals in the home counties to the elderly, basically, to try and pay the bills whilst also trying to do kind of slightly more exciting new small plays in London in the fringe. And so we did that for a while, but I'd always wanted to start a school for various reasons to do with the fact I went to a school that was started by some retired teachers, and it sort of seemed like a really cool idea. And my mate I was doing it with wanted to be a writer full time. He's now still writing, and he's writing movies very successfully. Mm. But he's moved on from the home counties. So to do that, I thought to start school, I was going to have to make some money. So I went to work for a consultancy, McKinsey, in the city when I was about 28. It was my first proper job. And then I was at McKinsey thinking, right, I've got this plan to start a school. And then the free school policy comes in 2010 when the coalition government came in. So Michael Gove was the education minister, and he said, free schools, anybody can apply to start a school and it'll be government backed. So I thought, wow, that sounds crazy. I better apply for that. So quit my job in 2010. And then with two other guys, Peter Hyman and Ollie DeBotton, we opened School 21 in 2012. So then School 21 was kind of 150 students, really disadvantaged, but very ethnically diverse part of the country, which was sort of really exciting in many ways. And there was a lot of energy because it was just after the Olympics had finished, literally about 3 weeks after the Olympics had finished, we opened the school. And so it was really buzzing in that part of the city at the time. And it's grown to 1,200 students and it's been very successful. Brilliant. But as I say, during that time, was starting to think about higher education because of all the things we've already talked about.
So you're a chief exec, so quite commercial, and then you also manage a highly regulated institution. Like, it's quite different. That's quite different in itself, again, to most vice chancellors at universities. So how do you balance the two?
I mean, lots of universities are run as effectively as businesses now, and we'll be no different. We'll have to make the numbers add up. But for me, it's about being a kind of agile startup and trying to keep that culture in a really regulated environment. Is there's lots of tensions because the way startups normally work is that you are ready to kind of move at 90 degrees, in a completely different direction at the drop of a hat if things aren't working, or not have to kind of check with 4,000 people that you're doing something right before you do it. You just want to get it done, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't really matter. And so that's not really how it works when you're a regulated institution. So we're having to find that balance, but that has been a battle. And also, our academics that have come to us, and they've come to us from places like Oxford and LSE and UCL and really prestigious places, Harvard, and they've left careers there because they're more entrepreneurial. But still, even then, it's quite testing for them to be in this kind of an environment. I mean, they're rising to it, but it's a challenge.
But they really believe in what you're doing then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they do. And that's it's such an exciting group of of academics, and they're sort of to have people who have got this range of expertise working together to create an undergraduate degree. I do think it's a first. And so they want to be founding faculty of a new university is a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Oh yeah,
so
I absolutely. Think
that's the way you can attract great people, by putting great opportunities out there.
What's the degree called?
Well, it's a Bachelor of Arts and Sciences. That's the first thing to say, which is something that UCL offer one, and there's a few universities that offer a Bachelor of Arts and Sciences, but ours is in Interdisciplinary Problems and Methods, which is a mouthful, but if you just break it down, it's exactly what the degree is. So we look at interdisciplinary problems, and then they also learn these methods I talked about, these kind of interdisciplinary methods. So you come out being able to take a different perspective on problem solving, and you've also got these tools like coding or survey design and videography and all that stuff in your bag as well.
It reminds me of, on our second episode, we had Clive Jones, who runs a consultancy on trends. And he talked about institutions should drop courses and instead focus on causes, because that's what Generation Z prefers. Mm-hmm. A lot of studies been done in that area. So I think what you've got going on here, it seems as though it's, you know, quite relevant to the times right now.
Are you asking Ed whether he was listening to episode 2?
No, but it just reminded me of Clive. You know, that's
what he was talking about. Though,
climate change and AI.
Yeah.
Clive saying, like, this is the theory, this is where, but Ed's already doing it. So brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope the theory works.
No,
I'm sure.
I hope Clive's right.
We hope so.
It makes so much sense, though. If I didn't know what I wanted to study at university, then something like that looks really attractive,
desirable.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, what does it mean to be an expert in a world where all knowledge is a click away online?
Yeah, well, when you've got Google, you know, why do you need experts in things? It's a really interesting question. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that I think it is very important to still have, as I say, people who have studied for 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or their whole careers in certain quite narrow fields. Because even if something's a click away, if you don't know much about a subject, it becomes very hard to Google it. That's what the cognitive science shows us, is that having things in your long-term memory helps you be creative. You can't hold very much in your working memory, so it's actually very hard if you don't know much about much. So first of all, we need deep experts, but it doesn't mean that everyone else just has to be the generalist and not really know anything. There's this kind of space in between, which people don't talk about very much, called interactional expertise. And it's the kind of expertise that an education journalist might have. So, you know, or you guys, so you kind of, you're starting to move to the space. You're not teachers, but you know about higher education. You know the lingo, you know the trends, you're talking to the experts. You can probably make connections that some other people might not be able to make. I would say you've got an interactional expertise in the field of education. And, you know, that's the same in science. There's people with interactional expertise in all kinds of different fields. And they're really important kind of connectors and translators for people. But it's not really a talked about kind of expertise. And I think for us, with our degree, these students will come out with that level of expertise in quite a few areas. They'll have the confidence to move and learn, rather than just sort of saying, I don't do the maths. Or if you're leading an organization, some people might say, well, I don't do marketing. I leave that to my head of marketing. It's like, well, you can do a bit. You can start to develop a bit of expertise in it, and enough, right?
That definitely
really make a difference.
Yeah.
I also find, so I don't know if it's related much, but once you get into the world of work, there's always something to top up. So although you've got your degree and you've managed to get your first year of experience, there's something that's still quite lacking. You have to continually top that up to get to where you need to be.
I think that's completely right. I mean, the idea that I was an engineer after my 3 years of engineering at Imperial was a complete joke. I wouldn't have trusted a bridge that I'd created, or I couldn't. I certainly couldn't
fix the lawnmower
or anything
like that.
Which one
was it,
so
we could stay away from it?
I did, yeah. Well, no, I won't diss it. But the fact is, you know, if you're going to be a proper engineer, you need to keep going, like you say. Mm-hmm. You need to keep learning and keep developing. So the idea that we are expert after our undergraduate degree is a bit of a nonsense anyway. It's more that you've reached a certain level. But that's right. We need to keep learning. And I think the practice of that and giving people confidence to do that now, where they, you know, learning is so much more exciting, in my view, than it was 20 years ago, where you did just have to sort of walk down a different corridor of the library and it was all a bit intimidating. That was how you learned before, you know, when it was dial-up, it wasn't much fun to kind of constantly be waiting 5 minutes for a page to download. you'd have to go to the library. But now, you know, not only can you Google the books, but you've got people who have made amazing animations and videos to teach it to you in the most exciting ways. Mm. And I think that, but you still need the confidence to go and do that. And so for us, there's a really interesting question on teaching design about how much do you spoon feed, how much do you create new content, versus how much do you help the students become fantastic learners and at harnessing what is already out there, which is, you know, you couldn't in your lifetime begin to devour 1% of what's out on the internet, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's plenty out there already, but how do you get good at that?
What does the future look like for LIS then? What's the goals, like 5 years, 10 years down the line? Where do you want to be?
Well, the whole idea around this is that young people shouldn't wait until they're semi-retired or retired before they start putting something back into society. And I think we've had a couple of generations of people, not everybody, but that has focused a little bit more on themselves and a little bit more on making enough money to be able to buy a house, and all of that stuff is fine. And then they get to kind of retirement and think, right, what can I do to put something back? Now, mm-hmm. we face a series of urgent challenges. I mean, these challenges are urgent now.
Yeah.
We all know what they are. And we need brilliant young minds coming out of university ready to try and get stuck into those problems right away and spend 20, 30, 40 years tackling those problems, not just sort of 10 years when they're actually past their best, right? You've got to do it in your prime. Mm-hmm. So that if we can see our graduates really starting to lead the way in that, in 5-10 years, they'll be very early on still, but you know, if they're starting to make their way in that world with that intention, and if we start to see other universities starting to think in different ways, maybe about admissions, maybe starting to think about how they can design courses differently that are more focused on these kinds of problems, that would be really exciting for us.
That's definitely brilliant.
Yeah.
That's
really inspiring.
It's so refreshing, isn't it, to hear it, rather than just, I want to grow to like 15,000 students. But we laugh, but this is what most universities are about, isn't it? Student recruitment and how are we going to get more students, whereas actually it's fundamentally about causes, and that's your goal as well for the students to tackle those causes. So I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. And it's not just you saying it, you're actively doing it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a difference.
Well, I think the thing about impact, and it can be quite crippling if you only think in scale, it can stop you doing anything because you think, well, I can't. You know, people talk about changing the system. And if you define that as literally changing the entire education system, you know, that requires being education minister, and even then it's quite hard. Now if you define the system slightly differently, if you define the system as the students sitting in front of you, now they're part of the system. So if you're a teacher doing something different, you're part of the system, and if you act differently, you're changing the system. I genuinely believe that. And I think if someone said to us, well, LIS will never be more than 500 students, now that's not our plan. But if they said that, I'd say, well, I think we can be an extraordinary place, and our students can go off and do extraordinary things. And if those 500 students are really up for it, they can make a difference in the world. And that, I can still get very excited about that.
Definitely. Sitting here smiling and nodding along. So
yeah.
I think that's brilliant. It's been amazing having you on, Ed, and really fresh, thought-provoking. And I do really wish LIS all the best.
It would
be good to have
Thank you very much.
Back in, I don't know, 6 months or a year's time or something on the podcast to see how you're doing.
Yeah, it would be great.
Thank you, Ed.
I'd love that. Thanks. Yeah, thanks to all of you. Yeah, it's been really fun chatting.
Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you're hearing, then please follow. Disrupting the Degree is brought to you by The Brand Education and Carnival Content.